Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our studio guest today is short story writer and poet Lucy Dineen. We'll also be hearing from fan fiction author Claire Guyon and poet Wendy Cope. But hello, Lucy. Nice to have you with us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, we'll be giving you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we're talking to Wendy Cope today, who's a poet, Claire Guyon, fan fiction writer. You yourself write short stories and poetry. There's also flash fiction and microfiction circling around at the moment. It's quite an exciting time to be a writer.
It is. And I think it's exciting particularly because these boundaries are becoming much more easily transgressed. So the sense of being contained in one form isn't something that necessarily applies anymore. So a lot of my work kind of creeps in towards the poetic or into towards non-fiction and back again. Flash fiction merges into microfiction or into sudden fiction, and you don't actually have to be constrained anymore by labels.
And you teach, so you must sense this in your students that if something doesn't fit one form, they can find another form for it.
Very much so. And sometimes you start in one form and it's not the right thing for that particular story, and you keep exploring and experimenting until it merges into something else. So a poem that doesn't work might actually turn into a short story or even an essay sometimes. So there's lots of room for movement.
I wonder why this is happening. I wonder if it's because we've got busy lifestyles or we're on screens more. So maybe if we're travelling or commuting, a flash fiction or a short story becomes more appealing than bit chunks of a novel.
There is a lot of talk that that's how our reading appetites are sort of directing the things we write. But I think actually in many ways that's always been happening. If you think back to sort of the turn of the 20th century, modernism, the experiment that was happening then with form and how to represent something in words that actually felt like it feels to be a human being. I think we've always been trying to push those boundaries to get closer to the experience of real life. And our 21st century world has just given us a few extra additional possibilities for that, online writing, hyperlinked writing, that sort of thing. But I think that impetus has always been there. We're just seizing it harder.
Well, we'll be talking a lot about the short story, shorter forms of fiction, but we'll listen to your first choice of music now, which is The Rote and the Writ by Johnny Flynn. Why this one?
It's very much about the power of language and words. And it's something that I've sort of learnt the hard way a little bit, perhaps, that words have power, but they can do harm as well as good. So it's a little bit of a warning, this song, and I think it's worth remembering.
Taking pictures of the man from God, hope his cassock's clean. Mudn't have been a holy fellows, your halo better gleam, better gleam. What of all those wayward priests, the ones who like to dream?
That's The Rote and the Writ by Johnny Flynn, the first choice of music from our studio guest today on Bookmark, Lucy Dineen. Lucy's fiction and poetry has been shortlisted for awards, including the Bridport Prize and the Manchester Fiction Prize. It's appeared in journals across the UK, Europe and America, including Two Thirds North, Litro and the Stockholm Review of Literature. Her first short story collection, Wild Gestures, was published last year. The Australian described it as stunning, and it won Best Short Story Collection at the Saboteur Awards. Congratulations on
that,
Lucy. We're going to talk about Wild Gestures in detail throughout the show, but let's rewind a little bit and talk about your journey to becoming a short story writer. Was it always that form that you were going to write in?
It was actually almost going to be never that form. I think I was 3 years old when I told my dad that I wanted to be a writer. And I knew very much it felt like something inside me that was going to have to happen. But I always thought I'd be a novelist. That was always my goal. When I write, I used to be very, very waffly. I used to have a lot to say. And I thought the only way I could say it was through a novel. it wasn't until I did a master's in creative writing at Plymouth University back in 2004 that I actually really discovered the short form at all. I could probably honestly say I hadn't really read a short story before that. It was very much, you know, wrapped up in novels. And it was discovering stories like, you know, Raymond Carver's What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, Hemingway, Hills Like White Elephants, Chekhov, all of these writers, the key writers in the literary canon, just opened my eyes to the possibility of the form. And once I got into it, I couldn't get out again. It was addictive.
What is it about that form that appeals to you?
It's a very versatile form. You don't have to be the same voice twice, which is rather nice. I think with a novel, you've got that sustained voice, and I envy writers who can do that. But I think that sort of almost like an act of ventriloquism, you can be these different characters, pick things up, put them down. There's definitely a satisfaction in being able to finish something in a relatively short space of time as well. But I do love the tricksiness of the form, the way that you can lead your reader astray, throw something that they're not expecting into the mix. And then you can do it all over again a couple of weeks later in a different way, which is really exciting.
And can you pin it down to what makes a good short story?
I think an element of surprise needs to always be there. I think we've perhaps moved away from that typical twist in the tail ending that we associate with 19th century short stories. But at the same time, a good short story will make us see something differently by the end of it, something we didn't expect. So that surprise might be quite subtle, but I think it's always present. But it's also about the shape of the story. The short story sees the world differently. So it's giving us a different glimpse on our own self and our existence and our experience.
And you can linger on a moment. It can be literally a story, just in a brief form, or lingering on a moment. Is the one that particularly you like?
I love the idea of lingering on a moment. There's a famous quote by V.S. Pritchett where he says, "The short story is the moment glimpsed in passing." And it's that sense of, you know, the conversation you sort of snatch over, you overhear a little bit of on the bus, or a photograph that you see and all you've got to work on is what's contained in that image. And I think a lot of my own short stories work on that basis of that moment glimpsed, that you don't have a past and a future, but you've got this out of time moment.
And are there particular writers that you admire?
Well, I do love Raymond Carver, and I was told once that you can learn everything you need to know about the short story by reading Chekhov, which I think is probably true. I love writers like Amy Hempel, Kelly Link. They're very exciting writers. Going right back to sort of the craft of the sentence, I think I really admire writers who are really playing with words and getting their hands dirty with the actual, the physical building blocks of the story itself. Not doing anything fancy, no cheap tricks, as Raymond Carver would say.
And some writers in particular seem to pull away from short stories because they think they're going to be harder to get published. Is that true?
I think it is true they're harder to get published. I think there's a certain resilience you need to have to persist with them. You're often asked, and I'm frequently asked, well, when's your novel coming out? Have you got something longer? I find that quite sad in a way, that the short story isn't given the sort of the autonomy it deserves, as it's always a precursor to something longer as opposed to being something complete in its own right. But I think there are many writers who are holding fast on that. For example, somebody like Alice Munro never felt that need to produce the long form narrative that might be demanded. So I hold on to that and think, this is my form, this is where I feel comfortable.
And while Gestures is your first collection, were you always working towards a collection?
I suppose it built itself up quite organically. And after a while, you suddenly realise that you've actually got quite a few stories and they begin to fall into certain themes and patterns emerge. Relationships between the stories start to become clear. And then I think maybe sort of 4 years into writing the stories, I realised that actually a collection was forming. It wasn't a conscious... In fact, actually, it had started life as a novel. But the thrust of the novel almost had to be exploded into these different fragments to really find its power. And so the stories do have lots of common threads and reflecting back on certain motifs and ideas. And that comes, I think, from their origin as a fledgling novel.
Yeah, so it's very much a collection, not an anthology. There are 17 stories in it. Yeah. Well, one's a poem. Really, isn't it? Does it count as a poem? What would you say?
Actually, that's sort of interesting because that's actually an error, because the story, that little poem was meant to be the sort of like a little kind of epigram for the collection, and it somehow in the proofreading didn't it made its way into
it
the main.
Its way it in. It was determined
in.
To be there.
And people always ask about it as, you know, it's the opening. It becomes the opening piece, which of course it was never intended to be. It was I'd really wanted a little quote from T.S. Eliot, and the permissions were tricky. So it was I threw in this little poem, and it's suddenly taken this life of its own. But this is what I was saying about forms being quite fluid. I think that it doesn't have to be categorised as a poem. I think there's a narrative element to that little piece. And it speaks to the greater themes of the collection itself, which is often about women's experience and women's invisibility and women's struggle to find a voice.
Was it easy to decide what to leave out and what to put in?
Yes, because at some point you start to realise that although some stories seem quite good when you're writing them, 2 years on, 3 years on, you realise the quality is perhaps not what you imagined in the first instance. So as I gained a bigger range of stories to look at, I could just see the ones that were better. And I could see the ones that were practice stories, if you like. I was kind of cutting my teeth with them, and that seemed more evident. So they could be discarded.
And cutting your teeth, you do teach short story writing.
I
now
do.
At
yeah.
The Institute for Continuing Education,
yes.
part of the University
yes.
of Cambridge. It's obviously still very much alive, still lots of enthusiasm for it.
Increasingly so. I think it's more and more we're interested in that aspect of craft and learning how to improve craft. It's something like with any art form, whether it's, you know, music and sort of practicing your scales, or even something practical like woodwork. You know, it's a skill that you learn, that you craft and hone. And I think people are really enjoying the fact that there are places to go to learn now.
Well, there's a Centre for Creative Writing, which is newly
yes.
launched at Muddinghall. How's that going?
Fantastic. It's really exciting. It's a really exciting, as you said at the very beginning, exciting time to be a writer and to have that sense of a community of writing and writers developing. And the centre aims to be somewhere that people can gravitate towards in that sense. To learn aspects of craft, to meet other writers, there are interesting events going on. We've got a festival of creative writing happening in July, 7th of July, which is going to be really exciting. Really good speakers coming to talk about the craft and about the history of the short story, because it's actually one of the youngest forms of literature in many ways. You know, poetry's pretty ancient. The novel's, what, sort of 200, 250 years old. The short story as we know it is still in its infancy, really. So there are lots of possibilities for its future development as we move into the 21st century.
Well, exciting. Lots of speakers you mentioned there. And indeed, I went along to the launch of the Centre for Creative Writing, where Wendy Cope was there, and grabbed a few words with her. Wendy Cope's first collection of poetry, Making Cocoa for Kingsley Amis, was published in 1986. Since then, she's published three more. If I Don't Know, which came out in 2001, was shortlisted for the Whitbread Poetry Award. She's also edited and contributed to numerous anthologies. In 1998, she was the listener's choice in a Radio 4 poll to succeed Ted Hughes as Poet Laureate. I met her, as I said, when she came to Muddinghall Hall to help launch the University of Cambridge Centre for Creative Writing, and we talked about her next book. So you've got a new collection coming out in March. How many collections in total have you written?
This will be my fifth full-length collection, and there's other bits and pieces, you know, a couple of things for children, and anthologies I've edited, but the sort of proper collections of poetry, this will be the fifth.
And do you ever look back on your writing and see if your writing has changed? I mean, do you have an inner sense of whether it's changed?
Well, I do look back on it because I do a lot of readings, and I always read some of the old ones. And yeah, I think it's changed. I mean, I think I'm actually not as funny. This is not a good thing to say because it put people off buying the book. And there are still some funny ones, but I think I'm not as funny as I used to be. When I was miserable, I wrote more funny poems than I do now. But having said that, you know, there is some humour in the new book.
And has the subject matter changed, the issues that occupied you?
Yeah, well, when I was young, I wrote a lot about, and this, you know, a lot of women enjoyed them very much, but I wrote a lot about love affairs that had gone wrong, or quite cross poems about men. And, you know, since I've been happily with a partner, that has changed. So, I mean, in this new book, there is actually quite a lot about old age and death, because at my age, that does become a preoccupation. I'm really putting everyone off, aren't I?
Well, no, those are preoccupations for...
It's not all about that. I mean, you know, there's a whole series of poems. I was commissioned to write some poems about Shakespeare for the anniversary in 2016. So there's about 8 or 9 poems that are to do with Shakespeare. You know, there are various, some of the ones I read, like the one about the Archbishop or the one about John Case, they're not all about growing old and dying, but there is, you know, and there's quite a lot sort of looking back. One of my favourites is about a reunion dinner I went to at my old college.
And I suppose the obvious question is, having been writing for so many years, does it get easier?
In some ways it does, actually, because I think I'm a bit more confident now. And when I was younger, I used to sometimes... some poems I just couldn't make them work, probably because it wasn't a very good idea in the first place, but I think I've got a better sense now of what's a workable idea. And I still write some poems that don't make it into a book because they're not good enough, but not so many. And I think it actually has got, certain forms, I write a lot of sonnets, and obviously the more practice you have with using those traditional forms, it does get easier.
And a lot of your poems are now in the canon. They're studied for GCSE, or they're used regularly at weddings and funerals. How does that feel?
That's good. I mean, there's a poem called A Vow that was in The Guardian, and it's been used at umpteen weddings, and I only know about the ones where people took the trouble to ask permission. It's nice if they do. I mean, I would never charge anyone a fee for using a poem at a wedding, but it's nice if they let me know. And it's been used at lots of weddings, not even in a book yet. So, you know, that... makes me feel good, really.
And your poem, The Orange, I've been at weddings where that's been read.
Yeah. I know, I'm glad that I'm pleased when people do that, yes.
And you're now living in Ely.
That's right.
How are you finding this part of the world?
We really like living in Ely. We're there, I mean, like a lot of people in Ely, we're there because it's near Cambridge but cheaper. My husband wanted to be near a copyright library, and he can quite easily get to the university library from Ely. I travel around a lot, but we live near the station. Ely's a really good rail hub, as you probably know. And I actually don't know if I'd want to move to Cambridge now. Cambridge's so big and busy, and Ely is small and quiet. And, you know, you can go everywhere on foot if you want to. And it's beautiful.
And does it inspire the poetry?
I read one poem about Ely. Were you at the reading?
I was.
I read one poem about Ely, and I've written a few more, yes, especially when we first moved, when it was a new place. I wrote a few poems about it.
And, of course, we're here because of the launch of this centre, the Creative Writing Centre. Would something like this have been helpful to you when you were starting off writing?
It's funny, we were discussing that earlier. I mean, I did go on courses. I went on Avon courses. Those short courses, that fitted in quite well with my life at the time. If there had been creative writing MAs, which there weren't much, I would have wanted to go on one. I don't know if I'd have been able to afford it. And whether it would have helped me, I don't know. I mean, now everyone goes on creative writing courses, and I think, I wish I'd had that opportunity, but I don't know if it would have helped.
Do you teach?
I've done some teaching. I don't do much now. I have done some teaching on Avon courses and other kinds of workshops and one-off workshops. And a few years ago, I did a series of classes at Kingston University. So I've done a bit, but I don't do very much now.
And of course, there's all this big debate about whether you can teach creative writing.
You can help people. I think people, certainly I benefit, well, because I benefit from the Avon courses I went on. You can help people a lot. People can improve a lot with just a few pointers in the right direction. You certainly can help people with some constructive criticism.
And a centre like this as well, I suppose it's about helping writers plug into a community,
yes,
and feel supported.
Well, that's another thing. I mean, when I first got interested in poetry, I didn't have anyone to talk to about it. And I tried my friends who'd read English at university, but it turned out they didn't really know much about poetry and certainly didn't want to talk about it. And then I began to meet a few people who were interested in poetry, and that was very important. And one of the main things of going on the Avon courses was that, you know, the other students were all people who were interested in poetry, and that was wonderful. And they didn't think it was peculiar and boring to keep trying to talk about it.
And are you part of a community now? Do you stay?
I'm married to a poet. That works quite well. I mean, people ask, you know, is that difficult? But there's lots. I mean, you know, he knows about the things I'm interested in, and that's great. And I've got some poet friends, but I'm not actually part of a workshop group or anything like that.
So you've got the collection coming out in...
1st of March.
1st of March. And what, then what's next for you?
I want to do a collected poems. You know, I'm in my 70s now. I want to do a collected poems. And then I might write some more poems. I haven't really felt much inclination. As I say, I've written this... last few months, I've written this cantata, which was commissioned, and that was really good, because I wasn't in the mood for writing poems. But, you know, once I got going on that, I enjoyed it. But since I finished that, I haven't written anything. I don't feel worried about it. But I expect I'll get an idea for a poem sooner. Whether I'll ever write, you know, it depends how long I live. Whether I'll ever write another full-length collection of poems, I don't know.
Have you ever been a writer in residence?
Yeah, well, for a month, I was writer in residence at Stratford-on-Avon Poetry Festival. That was fabulous. I had I was in a cottage outside Stratford. It was that summer. It was July. I can't remember which year it was, the year when there was a heat wave, the whole of July, sun shone the whole time. I had to go into Stratford quite a lot. I went to the theatre a few times. It was lovely. And all I had to do was I had to do one workshop and one reading and write some poems, one of which had to be to do with Shakespeare. And then I later got commissioned to do all those other poems to do with Shakespeare. And it was great. But I haven't done much. No, but I think that's my only time of being writer in residence. It was 2013. And there was a heat wave the whole of July, yeah.
And Anecdotal Evidence, a new collection by Wendy Cope, is, as we heard, published the first of this next month by Faber and Faber. So Faber and Faber there. Lucy Dunneen, your studio guest on Bookmark today. Your publisher is Midnight Sun. It's an Australian publisher.
Yes, it
How
is,
did
yeah.
that come about?
It was sort of one of those lovely fortuitous synchronous events that happened from time to time. I was at a short story conference in Vienna back in 2014, and met a number of Australians that had come over for the conference, one of which was a publisher. She was very excited by my stories. It is tricky, I think, to find publishers who will take a whole collection. I think the short story world is alive and well when it comes to publishing individual stories in journals. There are some fantastic independent journals currently thriving in the UK and all over the world. But it's still quite difficult to make that leap to a collection. And in the UK... perhaps it seems a bit harder. And my experience was that this publisher in Australia was less worried about the sort of the commercial element of the risk that would be involved with the short story collection, just loved the stories, wanted to see them out there. And it was part of a year of short stories for that for Midnight Sun. So they published three collections over the course of the year and really celebrated them. Also as part of the Australian Short Story Festival, which took place in October. That was sort of the culminating kind of point of that cycle. So it was really exciting to be part of that movement. And I think it's always great to have an experience of international publishing and to see how things work elsewhere.
It's a beautiful book as well. You must be very pleased with it.
I love the way it looks. I couldn't believe how beautiful the cover was. I hear stories of people who don't like their book covers and knit little jackets to hide them when they're reading. And I'm just so proud of that cover. I think it's stunning. They did a beautiful job with it. So,
well, let's go beyond the cover now. The themes in your writing, it seems to me, that come out in the various short stories, there's lots of themes, but you seem to explore missed opportunities, the things unsaid, the gaps and the spaces between people in even the briefest of moments. Obviously, that is what you'd like to explore. Would you agree with that, first of all? And
I think so. I think one of the things with short stories, because they are very much these captured moments, I think they do tend to steal and borrow moments from one's own life. I think that's probably something almost inevitable in some way. So when I look back at this collection, I see it almost as an MRI scan of a particular part of my life, when I think those were recurrent themes. I'm not sure it's what I would be writing about for the future, but certainly over the course of writing this set of stories, those were themes that were really preoccupying me. They were my own experience. I was trying to use the fiction in some ways to explore that, maybe even course correct things. You can make things happen in fiction that real life resists. So it was a way of finding the answers that perhaps weren't readily available in real life.
And without wishing to pry, that's the person, why were those particular themes interesting you?
It was a period in which my children's father was terminally ill. So I spent a lot of time in hospitals. I didn't realise until after I'd put the collection together just how many stories are either set in hospitals or on thresholds between spaces, whether that's literally life and death or whether it's something a little bit more metaphorical, but about those kind of transitions. It genuinely didn't occur to me at the time how much those were recurrent motifs. Flying and birds and leaving a scenario was also very much present, I realised afterwards. I think all of that very much comes back to that experience of watching a loved one go through a horrific illness, eventually losing their life to that, and how you emerge on the other side of it and try and rebuild from that. So towards the end of the collection, I think the stories leave that behind and start to look towards returning to the self in some way and moving on.
So these stories must be very powerful to you. It must take you back to a certain moment in time, as a snapshot, as it were, of that particularly traumatic period.
They do in a way, but there's also a sense that they've externalised that, they've fixed it in words, and that's a way of honouring it, but also letting it go. So it's actually quite a... When I look at them now, I don't feel sad. I just think that's a... It's a sort of a testimony to that particular time, and I'm glad it's there. It's a record of it, but it's actually... I'm not in that place now, and the stories are sort of... They're fossilised, if you like. They're a record of something that has been, not that is.
And you're going to be reading some of them for us shortly, but we'll hear your second choice of music before then, which is First Aid Kit and The Lion's Roar. Why this one?
This song always makes me think of the title story of the collection, which actually got renamed to And What If It Isn't? But the story was originally called Wild Gestures. I heard it had been shortlisted for the Manchester Short Fiction Prize back in 2014, and this song was playing on the radio. The story involves tigers, lions, tigers. It sort of fitted, and it makes me think of that.
The fact that they've been blindly deceived by those who preach and pray and teach, but she falls short and the night explodes in laughter. Don't you come here and say
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest is short story writer and poet Lucy Dineen. And Lucy, you're going to read some of your work to us now.
Yes, yes. I thought I'd read a very short one, so it might be complete, which would be
nice. Oh, that would be great,
nice.
Yes.
It's a story that was written actually originally for the Tube Flash project in London. It was a project that was connecting flash fiction up to the individual tube stations. So my story was in relation to Westminster Tube Station. And in thinking about what I might write, I kept thinking of Westminster, Big Ben, time, the clock. So it's a story that sort of, that's the driving force of it, I suppose, is time. It's called Countdown. The thing she had, the affliction, the syndrome, was like nothing the best minds in medical science had seen before. In the foyer of A&E, they lifted her like cloth sacking from my arms, gurneyed and triaged her. No, she had not fallen, vomited, taken anything. Her temperature was pushing fever point, that was the most they could say. Do we have her notes? The nurse wanted to know. She kept asking, even when the notes were in her hand. These are from geriatrics, the nurse was shouting. And then, does anyone else hear ticking? What I heard when I pressed my ear to Catherine's heart was the rage of memories, a shudder of years collapsing in. I picked up her hand and kissed its sudden smoothness, the tiny adolescent pearls of her nails. Look at this, she said, her voice soft as fur, and we looked as she slipped from the bed, cartwheeled to the nurse's station. I haven't done that in years, she said, hip height at my side, giddy and breathless and young. There were rumours, the specialist in experimental diagnostics said, of isolated cases like Catherine's, usually in remote areas, the places time forgot and then remembered, overcompensating. Cases of what was all I wanted to know, watching the hours flood through her, lightning fast. Was it catching? Was it curable? Can we get this place quarantined? The specialist said, looking through me to the picture window and the famous view that the tourists flew for a whole day to come and see. And get her back into bed. Do we have any books? Puzzles? What do kids play with these days? I took Catherine's hand, kissed her, let whatever it was that was happening to her enter me too. Don't hurt me, she said, crying, and I picked her up, rocked her in my arms, tickled her bare feet while the nurses took blood, swabs, measured the amount of time she had left. Tell me a story, she said, and I told her the one about how we met, which seemed more like a fairy tale than a thing in any book I'd read. The corridors telescoped away into darkness, but all I could see was Catherine retreating. Midnight came, and there was only one place to go. I took her up to the hospital roof, stared out into the wide night sky. Something to do with the clock was the theory, leaking out with every chime, every tick, every new moment. The fallout seeping into the Thames, pulsing up tide into estuaries, out to sea, to everyone. A pandemic, sighed the specialist, falsely stoic. I pressed myself to Catherine's sweet baby smell, rested my head against the place where her sternum was a bridge between her body and mine. And then I started the countdown, listened for the quiet stroke of the remaining hours in her chest.
Thank you. At the ending of that, like quite a few of the endings in your short story, it's not conclusive. You know, you're sort of offering something for the reader to do with as they will. I suppose the short story form lends itself to that open-ended format, really.
It does. And while at one stage, perhaps in the short story's history, 19th century Edgar Allan Poe, the sort of the event plot kind of twist in the tail end, I think we've moved towards something that has got that sort of sense of open closure. You feel somehow that the story has ended. There's a certain weight and a rhythm in its structure that tells you it's ended, but the actual moment is still open. Just as with the moment you overhear as you're walking down the street, you only ever catch that little snatch of it. You don't find out the resolution. And I think that can be both very frustrating for some readers, but it's also something that I think if you love the short story, it's the thing that really excites you about it, is the fact that you're left with possibility and potential. Depends on what kind of mood you're in on what day as to how you choose to interpret the direction of the ending.
It feels like a real connection with the reader because you are saying to the reader, here you are,
yes.
You do with it what you will.
Yes, yes. And I think that means that you can read those stories again and you can find something different in them depending on your own relationship with the story and where you are in your own life as well.
And that's set in an A&E department or a hospital. Some of the other stories, one is on a bus, one is in a bird market, another in South America, quite
yes.
a variety
yeah.
of locations. What's your starting point for a story? Is it often a location or is it an idea or a word?
It's the last line. It's always the last line. It's an odd way to write a story. I'm not sure I'd be advocating it at all. If I haven't got the last line in the title, I can't write it. So I need to know where I'm heading towards. That's just my own way of working. If I know that, then I'll be able to figure out a sort of reverse sort of plan for the story. It's not something I think works for everybody at all. I think a lot of people like to write and things unfold in front of them. I do it backwards, but
and the idea of a short story that it's like a snake swallowing its tail,
yes,
so the end is in the beginning.
Very much, yeah, yeah. And in fact, there's a wonderful bit of short story advice, which is that if there's a problem with the ending, it's normally actually a problem with the beginning. If you find yourself stumbling at the end, go back to the beginning of your story and examine it there, because that's normally where the seed of that trouble is.
And how many drafts would you have of a short story?
Depends on the story. I have some that have got probably 30 drafts or more. I have a couple that I think I was working through my head for so long before writing that they almost came out first time, which then they were tweaked. But that process in the head, I think, is as valuable as what happens on the page too.
And there's a lyricism to your short stories, I think, probably because of your background as a poet. But I guess in a short story, every single word counts.
It has to. It can't waste words. There's a real sort of poetic economy with the language. You can't afford to send your reader off down the wrong path too far because the sort of that intensity that the story spins around would be lost. But I think for me, a lot of that rhythm comes from music, actually. And I find that I listen to a lot of music when I'm writing. And for me, there's always a song that I associate with each of the stories. That would have been the rhythm of the story as I wrote it.
Oh, and that's actually in the story.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So the song we just played, the First Aid Kit song, is the Wild Jester's story. That's the rhythm. To me, that song is embedded in that story.
And there's a lot of myths there. You refer to the Bible quite a lot.
Yes. I mean, my background is I did an English and art history degree. So I think the art history element creeps in, and an interest from that the myths actually derives from my art history background in many ways, I think.
Well, talking about building on myths, that leads us nicely to Claire Guyon. She has written 15 fan fiction stories and two originals, The Selkie's Promise and Death's Doors. Her longest story, Spellbound, is almost 184,000 words long and has had over 200,000 views. Writing as Claire Bloom, she uses the Twilight series by Stephanie Meyer as the basis for her fiction. I asked Claire to start by telling me first a little bit about fan fiction.
Fan fiction is a site that is developed for people who enjoy a particular story or movie or TV show and they don't want the characters or the story to end. So they develop it with new stories of their own, but using those characters, which happens a lot in some films or TV shows where you're watching it and you feel a bit inspired and maybe you come up with a storyline yourself. Sometimes when people read, they don't want the story to end. I don't know if you've ever read a book like that where you put it down and you kind of think, what now? You know, you feel you want those characters to continue and the story to continue. So fan fiction is basically how you can do that. You can continue it.
And there seem to be some stories that people don't want to end more than others.
Oh, God, definitely. Yeah. I mean, the stories that I write for on fan fiction, Twilight, it just has so much inside hidden that's untold that people just grab onto that. And it's one of the biggest genres that is written on fan fiction. It just absolutely exploded across the world. So people just, I mean, they just don't want the characters to end. They don't want their stories to end and they just want to completely develop them.
Are you never thinking that you might just work in that genre with your own characters and your own story rather than using pre-existing ones?
Yeah, some of the Twilight fan fiction I've written, I actually then decided to stop writing it as Twilight and change it into an original story for myself because it went so far away from the characters and their stories and that it was completely original apart from the names. So I thought, well, why not change the names to my own and keep it as my own? So, and they call that canon when it's kept so close to the original. It's called canon, and then if you change everything about them except for the names, it's called non-canon. So that's some of the words that they use in fan fiction.
Are there particular rules associated with fan fiction?
Not really. You have to have a disclaimer on the beginning of your story to say that they are not your characters, but other than that, there's no rules.
And you attract the fans of the original as well as new readers, presumably.
Yeah, there's so many groups, especially on Facebook and on Twitter, that are basically just all about the Twilight fandom. And they're all about writing for Twilight. And they write on fan fiction for Twilight, but on different communities. So you have fanfiction.net. There's another one specifically for Twilight called Twilight Ed. And then there's Wattpad. There's so many different ways that you can write fan fiction and upload them online to be read.
And what is it about Twilight that particularly inspires you?
Well, without being offensive, the books are not that well written. She developed fantastic characters and a really good storyline. So some people think Twilight, really? Because they're not, you know, fantastic classics. But if you actually did read them and you grab onto who these characters are that she's developed, there's just so much you could do. She could write a book for every character and would be writing for the rest of her life, and it would be huge because she's given everybody such fantastic history. It's like they're characters that people can relate to in some way. Their stories are just fascinating. It grabbed onto me. I went to see the movie. I didn't even know the books existed. And when I came out, I was like, what is this? You know, it's just something, and I need more. And I Googled it when I got home, and then this whole world of Twilight opened up and fan fiction opened up, and I realized that I could continue it. I didn't have to wait for the next book and stuff. So that's how I got into fan fiction.
And there seems to be a lot of interaction in fan fiction between the writer and the reader.
Oh, definitely. I mean, a lot of them are very good friends. They develop whole groups and communities. there's one group that I actually developed with a friend in Australia. I say friend, we've never met. We only ever met through fan fiction, but we created this group on Facebook called Fanficaholics Anonymous. And our tagline was, where your obsession never sleeps, because it's so global. So somebody around the world is always online, and the group has nearly 2,000 members now. And they're all either writers or readers, or what they call a better, spelled B-E-T-A, which is basically like an editor. So people who don't want to actually write fan fiction, but they like to edit, because you have some fantastic stories out there, but people upload without really reading through, and you have a lot of grammatical errors and things, so these people come forward and do that. So yeah, it's massive. Everybody's friends and everybody's supportive and helping each other. And we do this thing called a gift exchange, where you send in a couple of ideas for a story, and then you get given somebody else's ideas and you write for them anonymously. It's like a Secret Santa. And then there's like a date where everybody publishes their story online, and then you find out who's written for you and what they've done with your storyline. So we've done that a couple of times. So that's how big the community is. It's like everybody's really supportive and helping each other. And people who've never written before can take part in it and write something. And it might not be as fantastic as somebody else's, but they'll still get support and constructive criticism to help them develop and stuff. So it's just brilliant. It's a brilliant community.
And does the author ever get involved, the original author?
There was, at the very, very beginning of the Twilight series, I think it was before Breaking Dawn, her final book was written, that she wrote a review on a fan fiction story herself and thanked them for developing the story and going in the direction that that person had done on fan fiction. So it exploded, obviously, on the internet, along the Twilight community, because people were just amazed that she's actually come on and read some fan fiction right at the very beginning. We don't know if she still does, but she did leave a review on somebody's story.
And what makes good fan fiction? Because sometimes probably you'll read things and you'll think that doesn't quite work. So what makes it work?
It's all about taste, I suppose. Some people prefer what they call all human. So as you know, with Twilight, it's about vampires and shapeshifters and werewolves. So some people prefer that. They prefer it being kept canon, so they prefer to have it as vampires and werewolves and shapeshifters and things. And then some people prefer it to be all human, so they like it when there's no vampires involved and there's nothing supernatural about it, and it is about everyday life. So it really is about taste.
And what next for you? Do you see yourself carrying on doing Twilight fan fiction, or has something else caught your imagination?
I've just taken part in another gift exchange, and there's another one coming up. One of them again is to do with Twilight, so I'm thinking of taking part in that again, because it helps to keep my creative juices flowing. But I am currently writing two original stories as well, so yeah, I like to keep my fingers in all the pies, if you know what I mean. It's I get so many ideas all the time that sometimes I just have to write them down, and I have like three or four things on the go, so that's kind of what that is at the moment.
That's Claire Guyon there, and you can find her writing as Claire Bloom on fanfiction.net. We're coming to the end of our time with you on Bookmark, Lucy Dineen, but if you were a fanfiction writer, what would you be writing on? Is there something that grabs your, you know, you want to take those characters further?
I find actually that tends to happen more for films with me. There are films that I've seen where I just obsess over them for a while longer. But I suppose The English Patient, my favourite novel, I'd love to pick up elements of those characters and see what happens to them.
It must be very flattering as an author that people feel so, even though she said, you know, she didn't feel the books were very well written. Obviously, there's something about the characters that's grabbed her.
Oh, I'd love it. With my Wild Gestures story, somebody wrote to me once and said they'd love to see it as a film, and they had this kind of this whole scenario they'd already planned out as to what happened to the characters. And because it was a short story, I felt that the point was we didn't know what happened, but I loved that they had lived on in this person's mind, and that they'd taken the time to tell me that as well. So yeah, I'd love to see someone pick up my work and fan fiction it,
take it elsewhere. And I'm going to ask you the question that you say annoys you a little bit. Are you ever going to write a novel, or are you sticking with short stories?
If I would like to, and I'm not going to lie, I love the idea that short stories are wonderful, but I'd like to build on that success of the collection, and I think the novel is the way to do that. I do understand that's how it works. I think if I write a novel, it's going to be very fragmented, and it's going to really draw on my short story roots. It's going to feel as though it comes from that place. But at the moment, I'm actually working on a collection of essays, travel writing essays. So the novel, for the time being, is it's there. It's sort of a nascent idea in my head. When the time's right, I think it will find its way to the page. But it's not shouting loud enough just yet.
It's not getting there just yet. And the question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark: what are you reading at the moment?
What am I reading? I'm a bit obsessed with Marina Abramović at the moment, so I'm reading her autobiography, Walk Through Walls, and I'm loving that. She's just an amazing character. I was just in Stockholm at the weekend, and I went to the Modern Art Museum there and bought an enormous poster of her.
And who is she? I'm sorry, I don't know.
She's a performance artist. She's Serbian. She was famous particularly for her exhibition at MoMA, where she sat, the artist is present,
yes.
Where she sat and people came and she just looked opposite them.
Oh, and her next lover arrived.
Yes, absolutely. And Heather Rose, an amazing Australian writer, she wrote a book called The Museum of Modern Love, which fictionalises that story. And I read that, was blown away by it. And from that, then started to read more about Abramović herself. And so I've got this enormous poster of her on my wall now, which I sort of look at for inspiration. I think she speaks to me because she's pushed her art in directions that, you know, she got a lot of criticism for. She's really not afraid to do things that challenge or provoke controversy, and I love the guts that she's got in terms of that, and the way she's so frank about everything that she's doing. I'd love to follow that kind of line in my own writing. So she's a bit of a goddess to me at the minute. So I'm reading her autobiography with sort of, you know, turning the pages frantically to see where she's gone next.
Well, I would recommend anybody to go online and watch that moment where her lover turns up.
It's absolutely amazing.
Because they can't talk, can they? All they can do is eye contact.
It's just the eyes and her face and the body language and the energy of that.
Oh, if it doesn't have you weep, you have no soul.
Absolutely. God, yeah.
We'll come back to you in just a moment to find out your last choice of music. But a heads up that on our next show, a studio guest is Miranda Doyle. She'll be talking about her memoir, A Book of Untruths. We'll also hear about the Bolsham Map Project, which tells the history of a village through maps. And Rob Shoreland Ball will be talking about his book, the definitive book, really, on Cambridge Railway Station. So listen to that if you're a fan of trains. All old podcasts of the show, all the old episodes of Bookmark, are on the Cambridge 105 website, cambridge105.co.uk. And while you're there, just take a look around that website at all the other brilliant shows that we do on this station. Shows about cinema, about food, all the different kinds of music. I do recommend it to you. I also recommend Wild Gestures by Lucy Denain, which is published by Midnight Sun. That's what we've been talking about today. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Lucy, which is On the Radio by Regina Spektor. Why this one?
She's another goddess, heroine of mine, and an absolute poet's soul. Her lyrics are just out of this world. A fitting way to sort of wrap up a discussion on poetry and its power, I think.
This is how it works. It feels a little worse than when we drove our hearse right through that screaming crowd while laughing up a storm until we were just bone, until it got so warm.